Ladies and gentlemen, as you know, we have something special down here at Birdland this evening. A recording for Blue Note Records.
And I would like to play a little tune I just composed not so long ago.
Miss Billie Holiday.
The music called jazz.
Guys are doing there. He's a really, really important thing, you know, and I'm very glad to be a part of it.
Oh, mate, thank you.
Yeah, I mean, telling Andrew, it's like taking you 10 years to actually compile and put this all together. And I mean, that's enough for anyone, I suppose. But when you consider that you're actually a DJ and a professional musician, you're a very successful recording artist. I mean, you've had 15 albums now, haven't you?
Yeah, that's right, 15. Yeah.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. So, wife, two kids. You know, how the hell do you do it, mate? I mean, you went round. You went up from Scotland all the way down to the deepest depths of Devon, talking to all these people. What made you do it?
Well, I did it really because two main reasons. The first reason was that I just felt that there was a lot of information getting forgotten about our scene, considering it is quite recent history, and you know, as far as club culture goes in the UK, and yet there was already a lot of information getting forgotten and a lot of detail. Secondly, you know, that book, Last Night a DJ Saved My Life, even though it's an incredible world kind of bible of club culture, I can't believe that they missed us out of the book, you know, entirely. And I thought it was disgusting that, you know, they just, you know, when you consider that scene at its height was probably as big as the house music scene ever was, you know, and I'm talking about from the jazz funk side of things, you know, and being as I'm so involved in that scene, from, as you say, as a recording artist, a musician, and as a DJ, and I thought, well, if anyone's going to do it, I may as well do it, because someone needs to document it. And
you've been in it, haven't you, since the late 70s as well, and what really gripped you about the jazz side of things? Because you were a in fact, a teddy boy, aren't you, really? Your brother got you involved in that side of the rockabilly side of things.
Yeah.
And then you went to a club and you heard Chris Hill and basically he blew your ears off, didn't he? Just
That's exactly what did happen, yeah. I was in a bit of a wilderness, really, because I came out of the rock and roll rockabilly scene because there was just too much violence in it at the time, and I just got sick to death of every time I went out, you always knew there was going to be trouble. And so when I was at college, I really had nowhere to go. I had no social life, and a friend of mine tried to drag me down to this club that was only a few miles away from me called the Goldmine. I didn't realise at the time that it was like the number one club in the country, and I never heard music like it in my life. I walked in there and it just hit me like a ton of bricks. And interestingly enough, the fashion in that scene at that time was American 50s. There, everyone was wearing American college jackets and flat top haircuts, and that was exactly how I dressed, similarly to me. So I felt at home immediately. So it was quite.
I want to talk about that actually, because like the fashion side of it in particular, because 76, obviously the British punk scene did start, and we're not talking about the nasty side with the spitting. We're talking about people looking really smart, and we're talking about that 40s. 50s style. I mean, even you look back at The Clash and people like that, they had that sort of style early on.
Yeah, they did, yeah.
They were going out and checking out this music, weren't they? They were going to Ilford. I mean, we're talking Susie Sue, we're talking Billy Idol. They were going to the Lacey Lady and listening to this music.
Johnny Rotten, the Bernie Rose, the manager of The Clash, early members of the Subway set. You see, I mean, as the fashion journalist and club runner Chris Sullivan says, that, you know, what we associate as being the punk look, I mean, it was, you know, fashion in those days, the idea was to be as outrageous as possible. And I remember that in the clubs, that it was when I was first going to like the Goldmine, for instance, you know, you would get fashion students from Southend College and from St Martin's in London, and they were dressing as outrageous as you possibly could, you know. I mean, it was about how outrageous and extreme you could become. And of course, the early punk wear, you know, people mustn't forget, the original punk wear was designer wear. I mean, all these shops, you know, Sex and Seditioners, and these were designer wear shops that owned by Vivian Westwood and Malcolm McLaren. You know, it's not surprised that people like Johnny Rotten wanted to turn his back on it back on the punk scene quite quickly, because it wasn't what the scene that he kind of got involved in the first place. Although, you know, I mean, Johnny Rotten actually was quoted as saying that he was, you know, that his roots are much more clubs like soul clubs like the Lacey Lady rather than punk clubs like the Roxy. You know, that's and I think that's quite telling, really. It's quite an indication of really where they were in those days.
Everyone was sort of mixing together, weren't they? I mean, the Soul Boys were wearing the same sort of clothes as the punks as well. And the music side of things, were they into the music? Were they into the jazz?
Yeah, well, they were, you see, because, like, I mean, you know, I mean, some of the really, you know, early dancers, like Tommy Mack, who was a white guy, and Trevor Shakes, Des Parks, a lot of these early dancers, you know, I mean, like, you know, they were dressing in all this outrageous punk stuff, and yet they were, like, considered the top dancers of the time. They'd be going around all around the south of England to all these different clubs challenging other dancers, but they'd all be wearing their, you know, plastic red t-shirts and, you know, luminous peg trousers, you know, and stuff, because it was, you know, it was a very, very fashionable scene then, you know.
Talk about your history about it, Snow White. Talk about how it progressed for you. I mean, going to the Goldmine. Listen, said, what sort of music was Chris Hill playing? When we read about, I mean, the book, from jazz funk and fusion to acid jazz, what were the tunes? Because people in Australia won't really comprehend what he was playing, or what exactly were they dropping?
Well, you see, I mean, in those days, you know, there was no specialist nights, you know, in that scene. And, and like, the very best clubs played the most up to the minute, you know, black music, American imports, you know, the latest funk and my latest funk, soul and disco. Let's not forget, this is the days of disco as well, you know, so you'd be hearing funk, soul and disco, and of course jazz funk, the kind of stuff like, you know, like Ronnie Laws or Willie Bobo, you know, artists like that. By the time I came into the scene, about 1978, there was already jazz starting to get played, and I remember tracks such as Chick Corea, Central Park. I remember Brasilia by John Klemmer being played next to tracks like the Erasmus Zayas, you know, which were more like a disco jazz thing. And I don't know, to me, as an outsider just coming in, all that music, I couldn't differentiate one from another style of music at the time. It all blended in, you know, nicely in the night. So I think that's a good indication as an outsider that which I didn't know what style of music was what. You know, it all seemed to work together to me. But I did find that my taste in music, even though I loved all of it and was collecting all of it, my taste very quickly did veer off much more towards the jazz fusion that was being played. And for any listeners there that thinking, surely they can't mean the kind of jazz fusion like Weather Report or Return to Forever. Yes, that's exactly what we're talking about. They were dancing to jazz fusion records, you know, in some of the more advanced clubs in those days. You know, not all the clubs, but, you know, where you found, you know, the best music, you found the best dancers, and the best dancers wanted more adventurous music, and that inspired the DJs to search out more, you know, more adventurous music, and so it goes round in circles. Goldmine was certainly one of them, you know.
Mark, you were talking about sort of, you know, buying records. What sort of, obviously, these were record shops that were... Who was kind of stocking those records at the time?
It was quite common in most major towns, not just cities, to have record shops that sold American black music import. It was very, very common. And in fact, even in general chain store record shops, like we have one called Our Price over here, and of course your HMV type of record shops, you know, they would have a section even in those shops of black American imports. So you could buy these 12-inch singles in most shops all over the country, because there wasn't so many styles of music around in those days. Like, I mean, for instance, these days, if you're into house music, I mean, there's about, you know, 50 different breakoffs of house, you know, and going into a record shop these days, for those record shops that are left, that sell that kind of music, there's so many offshoots that it was very complicated. In those days, you know, you went into a black music import shop, you know, and you either had the latest disco or the latest soul or the latest funk or the latest jazz, you know, and well, obviously this was pre-hip-hop, of course, you know, so there wasn't so much choice, I guess you would say. But having said that, there's such a lot of amazing quality music around at that time, and that's not me looking through it with rose-tinted glasses either, you know, because you must remember that jazz funk, I mean, it was in the pop charts in those days. You know, the most commercial examples, of course, would be things like Street Life by the Crusaders, stuff like that, George Benson. You know, these were the more commercial end of the jazz funk scene. And, I mean, that stuff was played in any nightclub anywhere in the country at that point.
Did you day around, like, the home counties area in London, did you actually go up and check out Colin Curtis? Because, I mean, he was a huge influence, really, wasn't he? As well as Chris Hill.
It was less common in those days to travel all over the country. It was common to travel from one club to another. I mean, you know, that was, you did get in coaches and minibuses and go off to different clubs, but, you know, you're certainly not going to be travelling 200 or 250 miles in a coach to go all the way up to the north of England.
Yeah.
I think there was definitely, without a doubt, a north-south divide in those days, not just economically, but musically, just only because there was only a lucky few that were getting a chance to experience what was going on in other parts of the country, and that may only be people that had relations in the other parts of the country. DJs didn't travel all over the country in those days. You tended to be big in the north or big in the south. I don't really think it was probably till the mid-80s that the DJs started getting booked in different parts of the country. So, you know, remember, of course, that in the north of England in those days, certainly from a black music perspective, you know, Northern Soul was the most domineering style of music up there at that point, you know, and it took someone like Colin Curtis and Ian Levine to leave the Northern Soul scene and say, no, I want to play all this great new music that's being made. I mean, obviously, Colin Curtis and Ian Levine were the biggest DJs in the Northern Soul scene, so it was a big shake-up for them to move from one scene to another. But, of course, by them doing it, a lot of the other Northern Soul DJs came out of that scene as well and started experimenting with all this new music as well. So it was a very much different scene in the north of England to the south. In the south, it wasn't about who's got the rarest record, it was who's got the newest record. You tended to go and follow the DJs that you knew you were going to hear these records first, you know, before anyone else. But, you know, that was the thrill of going into some of these clubs and supporting those DJs. You see, the thing is, those records were coming over as imports. The higher echelon DJs had the best taste, so they were picking up on a lot of these records quicker than some other DJs, you know, who were kind of waiting for the established DJs to break these records so they could then play them, you know. You knew full well that when you went to see Chris Hill or George Power or Chris Brown and these kind of DJs, you knew you were hearing these records first, and it felt exciting. It felt exciting being in these clubs. I don't know, it wasn't a snobby thing, but you did feel like you were somewhere exclusive, because it was, if you're into music that much, of course you want to hear it as quick as it can
possibly be heard.
I can't even imagine being in a club and hearing for the first time Expansions or something like that back then. That must have blown your head off.
Right. Although you do remember what it was like the first time you heard Expansions, though, don't you?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
I mean, I didn't hear it as a new release. I heard it got reissued in 1978 through popular demand in the South. Richard Serling was working for RCA at the time, and he, because of the demand down South for it, because don't forget it came out in 1975 as an album track, the 7-inch single, came out as a 12-inch single, and we all heard it for the first time in 1978, and I must admit, the first time I heard it, I never, ever heard anything like it in my life. I mean, and even though I've heard it 1,000 times, I still get a tingle when I hear it, because I still remember what it was like the first time I heard it. We'll be right back.
you sitting comfortably?
Frederick lies still.
Salutations from Jalal of the Last Poets. When you hear the band play hard, you'll be listening to their trump card that has the vital ingredients of acid jazz that can only be found down at the Ace of Clubs.
So what makes, like, you know, a disco track, and what makes a, you know, a jazz fusion funk track sort of thing? I mean, what was kind of the, you're talking about going to clubs and who was playing the newest, and there was the more sort of commercial stuff.
Mm-hmm.
What was defining as far as, say, something like acid jazz, for example?
Right, well, I mean obviously the acid jazz scene was much later, and the reason acid jazz, in fact we'll talk about acid jazz first before we go back to the jazz funk and fusion thing, is that the reason acid jazz kind of disintegrated in the end is because really acid jazz was more of a scene more than a style of music. Like every individual that has heard that music worldwide thinks they know what acid jazz is, but in actual fact, like any of these record labels or any of these club nights, and you'd hear Latin jazz, you'd hear drum and bass, you'd hear house, you'd hear hip hop, you know, Afro-Cuban, Brazilian music, and people would say, well, what is acid jazz exactly? You know, it was a joke that kind of got out of hand amongst the clique in London. Beforehand, it was just you had the jazz dance scene, which was much more kind of militant kind of jazz. You know, by the mid 80s, there was a lot of kind of bebop and fusion and, you know, Afro-Cuban jazz being played, the fusion, of course. And then on the more commercial end, you had people like Giles Peterson and Chris Bangs, Kevin Beadle, that weren't only playing jazz, they were dropping in some kind of rare groove funk in there as well, and some of the newer release records, you know, some of the early hip hop as well, and they were the clique that kind of came out with, you know, where this joke of kind of acid jazz came about, because they were DJing on a night which was pushing acid house, and the words acid kept on being flashed on the back wall, and there was all strobe lighting and all kinds of stuff going on, and Giles Peterson and Chris Bangs were DJing on this night, but playing their jazzy style of stuff, because in those days the nights were more kind of freestyle. You'd have acid house DJs, and you'd have jazz, you'd have funk, and Giles was playing some really heavy Latin jazz track, and there's this word acid keeps on flashing behind him, behind the DJ decks, and Giles turned around to Chris Bangs and said, what on earth is this all about? You know, and Chris Bangs went, oh, it's acid jazz.
Radio 1 DJ Giles Peterson gives us his side of the story.
Was it your fault, Giles?
Well, you know, the whole thing was, I suppose, the problem that we maybe what was a bit weird for us was that we didn't really quite understand what we had in our hands at the time. You know, I mean, basically, it was quite a key era in dance music, and we fell upon a term which gave what we were doing an entry point for a lot of people who would never have got into jazz. And acid jazz, which was termed by Chris Bangs, clearly, you know, I think that we just never quite, we weren't very comfortable with it as a sort of marketing term. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, definitely.
For us, it was just a sort of fun there and then at a few parties, and we were like, you know, having a joke with it. But then we got a little bit upset when people started taking it seriously and actually making money out of it.
Yeah.
And that's really when it went a bit, you know, it was a bit like, come on, guys, do you know what I mean? Come up with your own thing. Or, you know, but if you're going to sort of, if you're gonna play off acid jazz, at least play off it in a progressive way. Because to us, it was always about something, you know, slightly ambitious and experimental in terms of how you approach things. And the problem is, acid jazz really quickly became, you know, a really generic term for really crappy music. So that's what upset me.
Now, did the humour come into it? Because what was happening at places like the Electric Ballroom, reading that book, that seemed quite serious. And a lot of pressure, especially from the dancers. It seemed like they were the guys ruling the club, when at the end of the day it should have been you ruling what you were playing, or Murphy.
That's true. I mean, that's another good thing that comes out of the book in a way. I think that we forget that. But yeah, you know, DJing to that crowd constantly was really hard work. To be honest with you, even though the music was really, really adventurous, and that is all due to Paul Murphy, by the way, you know, he created the soundtrack.
Yeah.
The problem was, if it wasn't those records, the dancers weren't really that interested. So in a strange way, it was quite conservative. So when you were DJing, it was like, you know, I could almost play the same records every week. It was like, well, you know, I can't be doing this all the time. You know, I obviously love the showmanship of it all and what it meant, but equally I wanted to have fun and you know, have a giggle and throw things in, which is why Bangsy was so important, because Bangsy was the, you know, he was the Eric Morecambe of the scene. But he wasn't just a sort of clown. He was like, you know, he obviously had a really good heritage and he knew the music, but he also understood that if we didn't, you know, take it further, it was just going to end up in a little room in the Electric Ballroom, which was, you know, which was really boring. So we went off and did other things. Although, you know, I kept on, I've never distanced myself completely from that music. I've always played it, and I've always done events, even up until now. You know, I'll still play at Shiffle Shuffle every year, and I'll still do, you know, a Dingwall session, and I'll still do a few of those jazz things, and that's great, but when you do it three times a week, it gets a little bit dull.
Now, how do they hold up to the original sessions? Because they're one-offs, are they really special? Because obviously you do it yearly, I think, the Dingwall's reunion, don't you?
Yeah, I mean, well, to be honest with you, even Dingwald, I mean, Dingwald is like, it's like a juggernaut, you know. All we've got to do is say it's on.
Yeah.
And we'll get 800 people turn up. But the thing is, I don't even know if I want to carry on doing that, because I don't like living in the past, basically. I respect what that was, but I don't want it to turn into a kind of reunion for old people to relive old times. I don't mind doing those things when I've decided that I've got nothing to say for myself, you know, in the newness, you know, like, but so maybe in 10 years time I'll be ready to kind of just do all those gigs with it again, or in 3 years time. But right now I still find it quite difficult. I mean, once a year is okay, just about, and the amount of people who, you know, the amount of happiness that people, you know,
I can imagine,
so happy. And it is really refreshing to kind of play to people who are so... It's like an Auburn Soul scene, isn't it?
Yeah, of course.
You know, in a way, I don't really want to... You know, it's kind of like, yeah, how many all-nighters can you, you know, go to listening to Richard Sterling again? I mean, it's nice every now and again, but I can't do more than a couple of years.
Let's talk about this book. What did you think of it?
What did I think of the book?
You're mentioned nearly on every single page. Did you find it quite uncomfortable reading in parts, or did you?
Well, not really. I mean, I can't. I, to be honest with you, I was dreading it a little bit, knowing Snowboy and that scene. You know, they tend to be a little bit anal sometimes, but as we all do, you know, because that's what we are. You know, us sort of, you know, nerdy record collectors. But actually, what I thought was really great about the book, there's a lot of humour in the book, and that's what I think is really good about the book, because Snowboy has not made it too serious in a way, and I think he's been a bit careful about not putting people, you know, in positions that would be uncomfortable. So I'm sure he's taken sort of some of the more nasty stuff out. Generally, I thought it was brilliant. I was really excited when I read it, and I think it's a brilliant sort of blueprint, you know, sort of report on what we've been doing for all these years. So it's sort of, I think he's done a marvellous job.
Yeah, he should be very proud of what he's done, actually, because to compile that 200-odd interviews and make a lot of sense of it, it really stands up quite well, doesn't it?
Yeah, totally. I mean, the thing is as well is that because there are so many different stories, in the end,
you kind of get a good picture of it all, really. You know what I mean? You get, at the end of the day, there might be a couple of inaccuracies in there, here and there. I mean, you know, I don't ever remember Colin Curtis coming to London and me taking him record shopping. but maybe I did do that, you know. But, you know, Colin says he did it, I did it, which is nice, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm happy to say that I went record collecting with, you know, a true Don.
Actually.
But it's cool, you know. I mean, I think also what's really good, actually, is that it's giving a lot of DJs like Bob Jones and Chris Hill, giving them all a little bit of a lift. You know, at a time when I think it's quite difficult for a lot of DJs to keep getting work. So I think that it's given us all a lift, really. You know, it's made us proud to have a little bit of that. You know, to have that heritage, because a lot of these books, you know, they've been written about dance music and they've been written about club culture. But funnily enough, a lot of what we've done on the fringes, has rarely been reported. And if it has been reported, it's usually been reported in a kind of, you know, throwaway sort of a way. Whereas really, what we have done in our little world has been quite, you know, it's been quite interesting, I think.
We should mention Paul Murphy, actually, he's mentioned heavily inside, and you interviewed him, obviously. I mean, he was a key role in the whole dance scene, especially with the dancers. Because of what he did at the Electric Ballroom. Can you just go into what Paul was all about and what he did?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it, with Paul Murphy, because people know him now, your listeners will know him now as a label of a kind of a house music label, really, and Afro Art Records. But, I mean, Paul's background, from a clubbing point of view, was going to the Gold Mine and the Lacey Lady. They were his backgrounds. He grew up with the music of Chris Hill and Bob Jones and other DJs such as that, and that's where he got his taste in music. And he's from Essex, like I am, and like Chris Hill and Bob Jones are. I mean, he moved into London to do a club called The Horseshoe. He got offered this club. Originally, this guy, he was just a mobile disco, this guy called Ray Reeves, who's doing a mobile disco at a club called The Horseshoe in Tottenham Court Road, which is in the centre of city of London. And he asked Paul whether he could borrow some of his records to play. And Paul said, I'm not going to lend you my records. If you want me to, you know, borrow some of my records, I'll come down and play them. And he went down, and they became just a partnership of playing jazz funk and jazz dance stuff. And they were just billed as Ray and Paul in those days. So this was, you know, before Paul was even using his name as Paul Murphy. But quite quickly, he amassed quite a following there at the Horseshoe. A very, very black crowd, and a lot of the dancers used to go there. And of course, and yet again, the dancers were spurring Paul on to play heavier and heavier, because the early days of the Horseshoe was quite commercial. And of course, he owned a record shop in those days, importing deleted jazz records from America. He would just take a chance on them out of, you know, in American music. You see, it's the adverts in American trade newspapers, you know, where you could buy 10,000 records for 5 cents each or whatever, you know. So he would just take a chance on all these jazz records, and he uncovered so many records that are now classics, that we would consider classics in our scene. And that was all in his tiny little record shop in Exmouth Market in London. And so, of course, when he was DJing, he was also, you know, breaking all the records that he was...
Can you give an example of those records?
There's a jazz fusion keyboard player called Barry Miles. I mean, there was probably four or five albums by Barry Miles, Alphonse Mouzon, Virtue. There were a lot of famous artists, a lot of these records were by famous artists, but on little independent labels in America that were gone under. You know, into receivership or whatever, or gone bust, and these records were just kind of ended up as what they were called deletions. You know, they would just be sold off cheap to shops. You know, and that's why Paul was taking chances on these.
Merry-go-round, that would be Paul.
Oh, Terra Massahino, yeah. And of course, that was the other interesting thing in those days. Of course, it's worth mentioning is that there was a massive fashion in the UK in that scene for Japanese jazz fusion imports, which were brought over just by one guy called Tony Monson, who was the main black music importer. He had a lead in Japan in those days. He was just taking a chance importing all these. He imported over stuff that he thought sounded interesting, and just taking chances on a lot of these albums. He was finding record after record after record of, you know, just dance floor classics over here. I mean, they've been very well documented in compilations over here. Like, there's a great series, I know you get over there as well, there's a series called Master Cut, and they do one of Japanese jazz fusion, which is, or Japanese jazz funk, definitely worth searching out for. There's a good example of stuff, you know. I mean, these records were so popular in the UK, some of them were getting in the lower ends of the national charts, you know. So Hunt Up Wind by Hiroshi Fukumara.
There's actually, in your book, you've got a chart at the back, haven't you? And
yes.
I mean, I have to admit, that's one of the things I love about this book. As soon as I picked it up, just like an old straight-nosed chaser, I went straight to the back, mate, and I couldn't believe my luck.
There was the
yeah, I loved it. That's such a nice touch. Is that your idea?
Yeah, well, I like charts as well as anyone else does, you know, being a record collector myself.
I love a chart.
I mean, I must say that, you know, I must say to the listeners that if you are interested and you having a delve into this kind of music and you're interested in buying the book, the charts at the back of the book are a very, very accurate example of what was being played. And it's going to be great for collectors out there, for record collectors, because they can just go down the list. And those records aren't particularly rare, are they? They're just, you can still get them for, you know, 10 or 15 bucks in Australia, I imagine, you know.
And some of them have been reissued, haven't they? You know, I mean...
Yeah, they have, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Johnny Hammond, obviously, I think everyone should own that album, to be honest.
Yeah, Gears.
Yeah.
Probably the greatest album that's ever been made, isn't it?
I think so, yeah. in Manchester, you had Tony Wilson and the Hacienda, obviously Factory Records and what have you, and signing Joy Division, and what happened there after that. I mean, that wasn't even successful at the beginning. He had a jazz funk band signed to him, didn't he, at a certain ratio, and they were actually bigger than Joy Division, which is quite surprising when you look at the cult status of what Joy Division is at the moment.
Wasn't that weird that Factory Records became such an important part of our scene? And it was unwittingly as well, because it was only when a certain ratio and Kalima started getting black music press, they suddenly started taking an interest in it, because it was a market they didn't know about. Factory Records, of course, were selling records to the Raincoat Brigade, you know, the indie kid, and actually they didn't know what to do when they started getting black music press, because it was something that they'd never gone after. They just really let their artists do what they wanted to do on the label, but, you know, because A Certain Ratio and Kalima, of course, they were so big in the indie world, and all their friends obviously were Joy Division, etc, etc. Of course, they were going to other clubs as well, to other black music clubs, and checking out the DJ Colin Curtis at Berlin, and Hugh and Clark, the DJ, and of course they met the jazz dancers, the Jazz Defectors, you know, which were kind of all-star dancers from the Manchester area, you know, one of the first jazz dance crews that took it off the dance floor onto the stage. And interestingly enough for the listeners is that Tony Wilson, of course, the owner of Factory Record, briefly, he actually managed the Jazz Defectors, and they would quite often go on tour, you know, with some of the indie acts as well. So, I mean, this is quite amazing, really. What an incredible crossover. And all of this really was nothing to do with the other jazz dance scene going on up in the north with Colin Curtis. They would just cross over into Colin's scene every now and then, you know. People like Colin Curtis and Peter Hagen, people like that, didn't really know what was going on down south in the jazz dance scene, and yet the bands did from Manchester, because they were gigging bands, they were going down south and playing at all these other clubs. And there's one particular famous club called the WAG. Kalima and the Jazz Defectors very much tried to put that element of the WAG into the northern clubs, but specifically the ones run by Colin Curtis. And I mean, that's the interesting thing about my book, is about 25 years of almost undocumented British club culture. For anyone interested in, you know, the roots of the Hacienda and the Factory Records, you know, that's all in there. There's football hooliganism in there. There's so many different elements to my book, you know, that all kind of, you know, and as you pointed out, that Factory Records thing is just one of them, you know, and quite a very important part as well.
Mark, you said recently that there's a bit of football violence in the book. Do you want to have a touch on that for a bit?
Here's the bold statement. Football violence killed off the jazz dance scene in the north of England. And why that is in Birmingham, one of the biggest crowds of football hooligans were called the Zulus. They were multicultural, if you like. I don't know if you call it multicultural, certainly, you know, mixture of colours in there. They're very unusual in those days. You started getting a lot of the football hooligans going on to these. They were having events in the Midlands and the north of England. They were having almost weekly events called All Dayers. All Dayers speaks for itself, but they were big events that all the best DJs from the Midlands and the north of England and put these events on in different areas every weekend. And they'd last all day, say, from midday till midnight. And there'd be, say, 8 or 10 DJs, plus maybe a live act. And these are enormous events, you know. I mean, they'll be in these big old kind of mecca ballroom kind of places, you know, where there'd be, like, 3,000 people. And then you'd have, like, maybe a smaller room, which they would do have, like, a jazz room or something, which maybe held 500. And what happened is it was quite common for different cities around the country to get coaches to go to all these all-dayers. But Birmingham had the most amount of coaches. And say, for instance, London would have 2 coaches. Birmingham would have 6 coaches. Each coach would, say, hold 50 people. The reason Birmingham had so many coaches, unfortunately, is because the Zulus started going on these coaches, because a lot of guys from the funk scene and the jazz scene, a lot of them knew people from the, you know, or some of them were hooligans themselves or whatever, and so their friends were hooligans. And what happened is like getting lots and lots of hooligans coming on the coaches. They would go there, they'd be alright, they'd be well behaved all day, but they'd be drinking heavily all day and womanising, and of course the ideal thing at the end of the evening was for a big punch up, because that's what they really wanted. And in those days, you see, there was a fashion amongst the football hooligans called casual wear. They would wear all the you know, latest kind of designer wear, like tikini stuff, and they'd wear the very expensive golf wear, Farah trousers, and that was also the fashion in the soul scene as well. So what happened is the doorman didn't know who the hooligans were and who the soul boys were, so they couldn't really keep them out of these big all-dayers. It was getting to the point there were so many of the Zulu football hooligans going to these all-dayers and causing trouble that in the end the promoters couldn't take the chance on there being violence in their events. So after a while, all these all-dayers petered out altogether. And unfortunately, the jazz scene in the north of England mainly existed around these jazz rooms that you had at all-dayers, because dancers would come from all over the country to go to these jazz rooms and compete against each other, you know, area against area. And some of these battles would be quite serious, you know, because it was a lot of area pride at stake. And, of course, when all these all-dayers disappeared, you know, the jazz rooms went as well, so they were really left with nowhere to dance to. And, in fact, a lot of the jazz dancers then started getting into house music and going to those clubs because they had nowhere else to dance at all, you know, so it was as bad as that. Hi, this is Mark Snowboy Cockgrove, and you're listening to 3RRR. I think in history books, I think that you have to be very careful about making personal comments. I think you'll be quite hard-pressed to find personal comments by me in that book, because I realise it is a history book and people do use it as a textbook. I mean, it's being used at Yale as part of their Afro music studies over there. And now Yale have picked up on that. I'm sure a lot of the other universities will as well. But they look at it as a textbook. But from the beginning, I was very keen not to put my own opinion in there. I think last night a DJ saved my life. You know, it's too personal, I think. You know, it makes too many personal comments, you know, and you know, they're not there to judge it themselves, in my opinion. You know, it's up to the reader to go out and discover that music and that scene and judge for themselves, really.
You've been quite tactful, really, because you kind of refrain from turning interviews into slanging matches, don't you? I mean, you kind of read between the lines and you kind of understand who's got a problem with who, but you don't really want to put it in print. You just want people to tell the story of the scene that you're incredibly proud of.
See, that was the hardest thing about editing the book, because you must realise that almost every interview I did was 2 to 3 hours long, each one, and I had to write each one out by hand before it was typed out. And what I did is I self-edited as I went along, cutting out all the rubbish. So personal and rude about other people and nasty. And there was a lot of lies being told, and I had to decipher all this and decide what was rubbish and what wasn't. And I didn't think it was right to put things in a book that person's going to have to live with for the rest of their life. Or I don't mind differences, area differences, but when it actually starts becoming personal, I don't think that's right. And that certainly didn't have any place in my book. 90% of the people that I interviewed I know personally, and you know, my book's not a soft option or anything, but I honestly didn't see the point in going in hurting people when they didn't deserve it. You know, it's just the way I am. I've had that enough as a recording artist myself. You know, where you go and read interviews sometimes, and people have been really nice to you on the phone, and when the interviews come out, you know, they've been really nasty and personal. And
I mean, I think you said it earlier, Mark, too. Like, this is really a book for music lovers, and there's no place, you know. I guess now, you know, obviously this isn't something that's going to be sort of running off the shelves, but people that will buy this book will find it, you know, just, you know, a brilliant piece of information that they can sort of draw a source from and feel, you know, sort of get a bit of an idea, be more part of it when they go out and find those records. You know, it's in particular here in Melbourne, there's a lot of places like sort of Northern Soul Records, and you know, there's many programs here on RRR that sort of pertain to this sort of music, and what we're sort of doing here. So you know, hats off to you, mate. It's a great piece of work.
I really do appreciate that. I mean, it's taken a lot of time, and I did keep on giving up on it because I just didn't think anyone would be interested, and I must admit I've been absolutely shocked at the reaction I've had out of my, you know, the book is selling very, very well at the moment, and it's also out in Japan as well. There's a very good jazz dance team in Japan. It's out actually in Japanese, which is, I read a funny story the other day from a DJ from, I think he's from Melbourne, isn't he, Ennio Styles. Is he from Melbourne?
Yeah, that's
right. He's from 3RRR.
Yeah, I mean, he's a great guy. I know him very well, and he bought my book from Japan, but he didn't realise that there was a Japanese translation of it. So
I hope he's having Japanese lessons now, is he? I presume.
Yeah, I know he's clever. I know he's a lawyer, but he's not that clever.
He'll be happy to hear that, actually.
I mean, at the end of the day, it's a comprehensive write-up of the history of the dance scene, really. From my point of view, I fell in love with it. There's lots of ah moments for me, you know, and there's lots of things in there that I totally didn't know about. And it seems to me that you've gone in there and you've checked and double-checked and you give them respect where it's due. And these unsung heroes, in a way, you've kind of gone out there and shared the wealth of knowledge that they have with us. I think it's brilliant. I'm really proud of it, mate. You must be so chuffed, seriously, to see
I am, mate. Someone phoned me the other day. Someone got my number. Some rough old black guy from East London phoned me up, and he said, mate, he said, I just want to tell you that, you know, your book's made me cry twice, you know, since I've been reading it, you know, bringing back all the memories and stuff. You don't realise, do you, with these things, that you are in some ways tugging at people's heartstrings in a lot of ways. Someone like you, John, that's lived that scene, the book's great for you, but also we're thinking that 90% of the sales are going to be from outside of the scene, that are interested in just an interesting music book, or, you know, or people that are just interested in elements of black culture or dance culture, or they want to buy it because they want to read about the football hooligan side of thing, or the factory side of things, or the dance history, or whatever. You know, so there's many reasons for people to buy the book that are nothing to you know, outside of the people that grew up with our thing. You know, so
I mean, the back of the book says it's music history, social history, dance history, Northern Soul, British black youth culture, football hooliganism, factory records and the Hacienda nightclub, the origins of house acid, Ibiza rave culture, the roots of British punk, the roots of the new romantics, the second wave of mod, the two-tone ska scene, cult street fashion, breakdancing and electro. I mean, if there's the listeners now, if that doesn't fire them up to want to go and buy it, I don't know what would. I mean, at the end of the day.
So. I'm hoping so. I want to get an extension on my bungalow.
So has it really been selling that well? I mean, are you shocked at how it's all going at the moment?
He's never going to rival J.K. Rowling, but, I mean, I know in the first week in Japan it sold 3,000 copies in the first week. I mean, so we're not talking about tens of thousands, but 3,000 that's a lot. I don't know what it's selling in the UK at the moment or in America, because as the publisher says, we're in this for the long haul. We've got 6 months worth of events going on all over the world to push the book, because people keep saying, when's the launch, in different areas. Well, we are doing kind of launches, but you know, it's not a bestseller book. You know, it's the kind of, you know, it, as you were saying earlier on, it's the kind of thing that sells over a period of time, and it's something that people will keep on picking up on. You know, once we get it into the major bookshops, the casual buyer will be picking up on the book, because I love the look of my book. I think it's very appealing, and, you know, I think even for people that aren't interested in our scene will look at the book and think, oh, that looks interesting, just because of the cover, you know.
I can see it in anyone's coffee table, do you know what I mean? To me, you just want to pick it up and read it. Everyone can pick something out of this book.
Yeah.
We should plug it. I mean, where can the listeners actually get this? I mean, I don't think anyone can go in a shop in Melbourne and buy it, can they? They have to buy it online.
Look, as of this moment, or I should say right up until this moment, yeah, it's just available on, you can get it on any of the Amazons. I mean, personally, I would ask people to buy it from authorhouse.com. Hopefully within a few months you should be able to go into your Waterstones and your Borders and buy it. But at the moment, there's no distribution through the major bookshops at the moment.
So if we get everyone going to Author House, then Snowboy will get that bungalow.
Yeah.
Get off the ground. Go fly high as a kite. Just look around. It's a wonderful sight. Yes, I rolled around you. You've never seen so clear.